Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, Project Zion listeners, and welcome to No Filter, a discussion thread here on Project Zion podcast, where we talk about sex and faith. So a little disclaimer today, our conversation would not be appropriate for young children, so take note of that. Our guest today, Colleen Payne. Colleen is the host of the Mormon Happy Hour podcast, which is a post-Mormon podcast with a unique, and for our Community of Christ listeners, I'll say read that irreverent perspective on post-Mormonism. So, hi, Colleen.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit first about you, and then a little bit about your podcast.
Okay. Me.
I live in Arizona.
It is hotter than hell. We are in almost October, and I am just waiting for it to cool down. I think it has just, like, as in this week, dropped below triple digits. Like, we're still burning up down here. So I'm miserable.
Okay. Well, we'll take that into account for our conversation today. So tell us a little bit about Mormon Happy Hour.
Okay, so Mormon Happy Hour is a, like you said, it's an irreverent take on Mormonism. I recently, let's say about 2 years ago, really went through a faith transition. And so up until about 2 years ago, I was, for lack of a better term, I was a believer. And so during those 2 years, I kind of took a deep dive into a lot of podcasts because I'm a mom. I stay at home and try and manage a house of four kids and two dogs and a scorpion and a snake and a lot of other crawly things. And, you know, it's busy. So,
your normal pet menagerie there, scorpion and snake.
I live in the desert. Yes, I live in the desert. Our creepy crawly things, actually all of our animals have dropped on our doorstep. That's pretty much how we get animals.
More than I want to know. Okay.
Okay. So the podcast. So I took a deep dive into a lot of the great podcasts out there for post-Mormon. Mm-hmm. We don't have to name them all, but of course, I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of them that have been long-term, well-known, and kind of chronicle a lot of people's faith transitions. Those were great. And then a lot of them that kind of attack more of the doctrine, and they're very deep, they're very heavy, they're very necessary, and I think that they serve a wonderful purpose. I couldn't have survived my faith transition without them, but I kind of graduated from them. I was done. I was done with the deep dive. I needed to find positivity in it. I'd reached that point in my faith transition where I just needed a positive future, a positive direction. But for as hard as I tried, I just couldn't kick my Mormon habit. I was still addicted, and I still, like, I followed all, like, I even went through and unfollowed everything on Facebook, and I still just went back and followed it all back up because I just couldn't. I was addicted. I just had to stay in touch with the community. I had to know what was going on. So I created a podcast for where I was. So I wanted to do a shallow dive in the current events with lots of humor and satire and poking fun at things and to keep it lighthearted and also to give others a positive direction. Like, I call them life pro tips. So we talk about drinking or other post-Mormon activities that you don't get to do as a Mormon, so therefore you don't know anything about them. And so we talk about a lot of things like that. Safe sex, general education that you don't get as a Mormon.
Okay.
We talk about a lot of, like, so those are the type of topics that I like to do. Like, someone once called me the TMZ of Mormonism, which I was like, sure, I'll take that. The lighthearted, humorous, right, skim across the top.
So do you want my number one post-Mormon tip?
Yes, please.
And that is that Starbucks is not the best coffee out there. It's just the most convenient.
Amen.
All right.
My favorite are the little tiny baristas that are like, you know, one location, mm-hmm. like the little stands. Those are generally the best coffee out there.
Those are great. We have those all over the Northwest where I live, you bet. So Colleen, you grew up Mormon, and that's what you were referring to, that up until 2 years ago, you were a believer. Mm-hmm. So was it a typical, what we would call a typical Mormon upbringing, big family, 3 hours of church every Sunday, family home night, all of that kind of thing?
Yes and no. Yes, I was born in the covenant. My parents met at BYU, got married at BYU. I was born at BYU. So, BYU is in my blood. My mother comes from a family of nine, and all of her siblings were all BYU graduates. Their father bought condos so that he had so many kids going through BYU that he's just like, I'll just buy condos. You guys can live there, manage out the rest of them, and then we can all just kind of, you know, it'll pay for all of your housing while you're at BYU.
Wow.
So BYU is definitely my blood. Me personally, I happen to come from a one-child family, and that's because my mother battled with infertility a lot. It has to do a lot with some medications that my grandmother took when she was pregnant with her daughters, with all of her children, and it affected her daughters reproductively. So I come from, I'm an only child, which is a unique experience when it comes to Mormonism. But other than that, it's pretty traditional. Family home evenings, seminary graduate, church every 3 hours, you know, and I wasn't like a super rebellious kid either. My parents will tell you that I was, but to be honest, no, I was not. I went to church with little fight. I, you know, did what I was supposed to do. I was a good kid.
I'm sure you were, knowing you. So, I mentioned BYU. I'm not going to say anymore. So, mentioning BYU, that BYU is in your blood, your DNA, if you will. You went to BYU, and this is kind of where your story of the ecclesiastical response to what happened to you at BYU weighed on you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that
was my shelf issue before I even know anything about shelves. That was my first like, oh, this feels wrong. But I just shoved it in the back and like just kept going.
So for those who are Community of Christ listeners who may not know what Colleen's referring to when she says her shelf issue, there is a term in post-Mormonism called shelf breaker issues that go on the shelf and you don't deal with them until the final one just breaks the shelf and everything comes tumbling down. Is that an accurate description, Colleen?
Yes. And it's actually comes from, I forget which wife, but a wife of a prophet or 70 actually coined the term, and it's been frequently used both in believing Mormon communities. Like if you go to the believing faithful subreddits on Reddit of Mormonism, people will still talk about, I put it on my shelf. Like it's a colloquial term that I was unfamiliar with until I left, but a lot of more people that struggle with the fringe and struggle with doubts, it's a common term because that was what was coined, I put it on my shelf and I will think about it another day, but right now it's not going to affect my faith is kind of how it was brought up.
So this is a pretty big thing to put on your shelf because we're talking about sexual assault. So, can you tell us a little bit about your story of what happened and what you put on the shelf and then what happened following that?
Sure. I won't go into too much detail with the actual assault because that's not really relevant. I mean, it is, but it isn't. I'll try and stick to the parts that are relevant.
The ecclesiastical response to that. Yeah.
Perfect. So I was a freshman at BYU. I got in summer term, which is kind of like the, you made it, but just kind of like skated by. So we're going to let you in summer term to see if you can really, really cut it. So I didn't think I was that bad of a student, but whatever. So I went summer term I was in school like 3 weeks after I walked in graduation. I had like no time to be a graduated from high school child adolescent. It was right at BYU. And long story short, I had an acquaintance who lived in the closest boy dorm to our dorm. He had an uncle that I got to know, but purely an acquaintance. he ended up luring me back to his apartment on completely erroneous pretenses, and then I was held captive in his basement room alone in his house for a 48-hour period where he sexually assaulted me. So we don't have to go any more into detail in the attack, but the thing that really, this is really interesting, but there's one thing to have a sexual assault in your life. There's an entirely different thing to seek help from your faith community and then be rejected or shamed by your faith community because of the sexual assault. And those are two entirely different traumatic experiences. And I have said, and I've heard from a lot of other people who share a similar experience, that it's easier to compartmentalize and get over the assault than it is to get over the mistreatment from your faith community, because that represents God. And so to be rejected by someone that your sole source of comfort in life, to be rejected by that is really, really, really difficult to kind of recover from. So it took me a long time to report, but when I did, I want to say I ended up going to the bishop about 3 weeks to a month after it happened. It was a while that I didn't really know what to do. I felt terrible. I felt worthless. I knew I needed comfort in my life. I hadn't told anyone at this point. No one.
So you hadn't reported to the police?
No, because I didn't even know that there was something to report. I didn't know that a crime had occurred. All I knew was that something had happened that I didn't want to happen. Something that had happened that I wanted to save until marriage. It had happened against my will, but I felt a lot of guilt and shame, and it's my fault because blah, 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 blah. You know, I tried to find where I messed up to make the thing happen, which is also really common in cases of assault. And I think for me, it also had an element of control. It being sexually assaulted and raped is something that you lose control, something is happening against your will. And for me, an element of putting my control back into it was basically blaming myself, because then that if I could identify where I did things wrong, then I could put this false sense of control back onto the situation. So that happened, and I just things weren't resolving. I felt horrible. So I finally ended up going to my bishop, my campus BYU ward bishop, because I was looking for that comfort, that solace. I felt worthless. I felt dirty and used, and I needed, you know, I was looking, you know, to my savior for kind of healing. So I went to my bishop. I described what had happened, but I never used the word sexual assault. I never used the word rape. I never used the word consent, because I didn't know any of those words really. They weren't part of my vocabulary. But from what I described, like, I mean, it was a 48-hour period. I was stuck in his room. I had no clothes. Like, if you heard the details, I'm pretty sure it's pretty clear what happened. But instead of treating it as assault and a non-consensual experience, my bishop immediately started handling it as if it were consensual sex. So he asked me to stop taking the sacrament. He gave me the miracle of forgiveness to read. And just to go back, like, not taking the sacrament is a very, very public form of shame. It sucks, because then all of my roommates were like, oh, what did she do wrong? She did something wrong. And then a lot of like anything that they had noticed that was wrong, that was different about my behavior, they could then, you know, explain away by saying that I had done something wrong and that I was sinning, and that's why I was depressed or withdrawn, or, you know, now not the person I was before the event happened. So that sucks. And then the miracle of forgiveness, if your listeners are familiar with Spencer W. Kimball in the 80s and his philosophies on sex and women, was absolutely abhorrent. And multiple times, more than once, within the miracle of forgiveness, it says that you are better off dying, fighting off your virtue, which equals virginity, than to live while losing your virginity or virtue. So in reading that, I'm like, great, I survived because I didn't fight hard enough. So then it's my fault again. So that sucked. So for like a month, I was not taking the sacrament, reading that book. And oh, and before I left his office, this is the item that went on my shelf. Before I left his office that day, he did tell me, if you find that you are pregnant, you will need to leave BYU immediately. And it was in that moment that I'm like, but why? Because nothing will have changed between that moment and now. And why am I being punished for something that I didn't choose? Like, I would not be pregnant of my own choice. I didn't choose to engage in that sort of, you know, pregnant-inducing behavior or activity. So why would I...
behavior.
Well, I mean, yeah. You know what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, that was my thought. Like, that wasn't my choice. So even, you know, if that's the result, like, why am I being punished for that? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that was one, you know, moment where I knew that what had happened to me was rape, but I didn't have that word in my vocabulary.
Right.
But I knew that it was not my choice. And so for him to say that, immediately I was like, well, that's not about my best interest, because my best interest right now is to stay in school and pursue a future and overcome what has just happened to me, not to lose. Like, when I applied to BYU, I didn't have a backup school. I didn't have a backup plan. It was BYU, BYU Hawaii, and BYU Idaho are the three schools that I applied to. BYU, BYU, BYU. And so if I lost BYU, I didn't have a future plan, no plan whatsoever. And so I felt like it was terrifying that like month or so, that, cause I didn't really understand how, you know, pregnancy and missing your period worked. I didn't know how long I would have to wait to know if I was pregnant. You know, I don't think it had quite been a month, because there was still, you know, that chance that I might be pregnant. And so it was absolutely soul crushing to wait to see if I was pregnant, to see if my whole life was going, if I was going to lose everything because of something, some choices that someone else had made in regards to my life, you know, something that had been done to me. So that was really my shelf item, was, you know, how could this possibly be in my best interest? This isn't about me. This is about protecting the image of BYU. And that really feels crappy. So that's pretty much the ecclesiastical failings that started my own, you know, shelf, if you will.
But you stayed a believer after that. You stayed a participating Mormon. So what transpired between then and two years ago, when you began to rethink your participation in that faith community?
Lots. So I ended up getting married when I was a junior at BYU. I ended up marrying a very bad man, and I learned under a year of marriage, he was arrested for for sexual misconduct with minors at BYU. And I found out when I was in the emergency room to get my appendix out, the police officers took him out of my ER room and arrested him. So that was really, really awful. And then he ended up serving a 30-day sentence in jail. And he was kicked out of BYU, obviously, for a multitude of things. This was just one. And so I obviously knew at that point that, well, I mean, I can look back and say, obviously, I knew at that point I shouldn't be married to him, but it's not that simple. I was Mormon. I had married a man, and, you know, we hadn't been sealed yet, because we thought we had sex before we got married, but we didn't, because we didn't know what sex was. Back to the whole sex education and Mormons. So we ended up losing the opportunity to get married in the temple because of indiscretions that we thought were sex and the decision of our bishop. And so we got married civilly, and we were preparing to get married sealed in the temple a year later. Well, under that year, he was arrested and then, you know, had to go to jail. And so, so this was happening in my life. This never ended. Fast forward to about 8 years of marriage. We were living in Washington, in Spokane, and we had applied to be foster parents. and he had decided on his application that he was going to lie about his criminal history. This arrest in our first year of marriage was one of about 5 to 7 similar arrests and a minimum of 5 convictions. And so this was something that kept going on, and I would go through this roller coaster of like, okay, he's going to get better, and then it happened again, and he's going to get better, and then it happened again. And I always felt the burden of, I needed to be the one to hold strong to the gospel, because that was my only hope that of happiness in my life, that he was going to change, that, you know, the gospel and the Savior and the atonement was going to work in his life, and he was going to have a change of heart. And that this wasn't going to happen again. And so that was my only chance at happiness, was to hold desperately. I was white knuckling the gospel at that point, because I had no other option, because, you know, divorce wasn't an option. Not really. There's so much stigma around a divorced woman in the church that I'm like, I don't want to live that life. I don't have another option. So, so about 8 years, we applied to be foster parents. He ended up lying on his application to the state of Washington about his criminal history. And he put that he had no criminal history. They ended up doing a background check and came back and said, yeah, you're a liar. So, because you lied to us, you are forbidden and prohibited from ever being a foster parent for the rest of your life in the state of Washington. And we will make sure that you never work with children in the state of Washington as well. You may not have contact with children on our watch. So, that happened. I got the rejection letter. That was absolutely devastating, because we had been struggling with infertility for 8 years at this point, and I desperately wanted to have a family, because that's what I was raised to desperately want. And I genuinely thought I did. And we can talk about that later. But another at that podcast, point, I did. Yeah. That's another podcast. Now that I have kids, I can tell a different story. but that's what I wanted. And so one morning, or that same summer, so we got the rejection letter. We had the opportunity to be foreign exchange hosts for some girls from China. And I was really anxious to do it, because like, this was a chance that I could have children in my home, and that sounded wonderful. So I signed up. It was a last minute thing, so there wasn't quite as much of an application process. They were desperate at that point, because they had kids en route and they didn't have beds for them. And so we ended up getting 4 girls between the ages of about 16 and 17, 4 girls from China that came to stay in our home. And they stayed for about a month, and they didn't really like him during that whole time. They liked me, but they didn't talk to him. They never made eye contact with him. They just had no desire to interact with him whatsoever. And when they left, I dropped them off at the airport, and like about a day later, well, we had fun that weekend. And during that weekend, I had seen, he would show me pictures on his phone, and in the gallery, I would see pictures that were like, that's odd. Like that kind of, can't really see, they're small, but it looks like there's naked something or other in there. That's weird. But I didn't push it, because I'm not a confrontational person. I had through 8 years of living with someone like him, like you don't, I couldn't confront. That never ended up well. I just kind of stewed and lived in denial and kind of tried to not think about the bad, because I couldn't survive if I did. And so Monday morning, he gets up, gets in the shower to go to work, and I roll over and grab his phone, and I'm like, I just have to know. So I opened it up, and sure enough, there was photographic evidence of him assaulting our children, or the Chinese exchange students in our home. And that was absolutely devastating. And it was in that moment that I heard a voice, and that basically said, if you ever want to, you know, have your dream of being a mother, you cannot stay with him, because you cannot achieve that dream while being married to this man. And I knew that that was true. And I knew that this feeling, and I had had a feeling of absolute dread the entire time those girls were in our home in regards to his behavior. And seeing those photographs, I knew in an instant that I could not protect children in my own home. And that was absolutely devastating to know that I couldn't protect children in my home. And so I had no business ever, ever bringing children into a home with him again. And so I It took me an entire day to work up the courage to call the police. Luckily, I had lots of support in my life at that time to kind of help me through that process that I kind of conversed with throughout that day to encourage me that that's the right thing and that I'll be okay, because I knew that my life was going to end. If I called the police on my husband for something like that, that was the end of my life as I knew it. He would lose his job. He was a child therapist.
Oh my God.
He would lose his job. And, you know, we would lose our reputation in the church, obviously. And, you know, like, I knew everything was going to end, that quite likely my marriage was going to end. Everything was going to end. And so I kind of took me literally a day at work to kind of come to terms with my life is going to end after today. And I came home, I called the police, they came over, they looked at the photos in his phone. Long story short, there were no charges pressed because the girls were already on a plane to China. There were no victims to testify. And in all of the photos, they weren't actually making eye contact with the camera. So they couldn't prove that they were aware of what was going on, which is bullshit, but whatever. China and America obviously don't get along politically. There's no extradition from China. China doesn't help us in any of our criminal proceedings. So there was no case. And so the state didn't pursue it. But the police officers took the report and provided it to his HR, because he was working it as a child therapist at the time, at the largest mental health nonprofit in Spokane, and provided him with his HR with the report, and he never worked another day after that. So, you know, there's justice in that he was no longer in contact with minors at that time. But then this is another shelf item. As part of me filing or calling the police and deciding pretty rapidly that I needed to end my marriage with him, I talked about divorce, and I'm not sure that I had filed yet, but within the week, he convinced me to go talk to the bishop about my decisions to leave him. And so I agreed. We went and visited our bishop. And then my husband proceeded to confess not only the details of what had happened with the Chinese girls, but also confessed to the same lewd misconduct that had been occurring at BYU, and that basically his entire criminal history, he was active doing that again and had been for 3 times a week for the past 4 months or something outrageous. Basically, when we got the rejection letter from the state, it kind of triggered a lot of his, you know, behaviors. So from that time until that summer, he had been, you know, acting out. And so my bishop knew all this, because not only has it come out of my mouth, because that was my reasoning for filing for divorce, but it had also come out of my husband's mouth sitting right next to me, confessing all of this and more to the bishop that I was even aware of. And then within a week of that meeting, so within 2 weeks of the occurrence of the misconduct with the minors in our home, my local bishop called him to serve in the young men's. And I was absolutely appalled. And I felt so unsupported in my feelings towards my husband's sexual assaults and misconduct and predatory behavior. I felt so unsupported in my feelings in regards to his behavior by my bishop. And then watching my bishop not only not discipline him, not warn others, but to put him back with minors was horrifying to me. And it brought back all of the feelings of that I had felt at BYU, that bishops make decisions to protect the image of the church or the school and not in the best interest of the victims. That all kind of came back to me. And I was horrified. And so not only did I file for divorce and pack up a moving truck and move everything I had from Washington State back to where I grew up in Arizona, and my parents didn't live there, I was just done. I had to go back where I knew was home for me. It didn't matter who was there. It just had to be a place that I felt safe. And so I packed up, I moved. And so not only did I kind of like purged everything from my life. Obviously I was no longer living in the same place. So it was easy to have a fresh start. But one of the things that I kind of like purged out of my life was the LDS church, because it was a community that I felt no longer safe in, because I had witnessed for a second time this blatant, absolutely abhorrent, you know, bad decision to protect a sexual predator over at the expense of a victim. And so So it wasn't even a matter of faith. It wasn't a matter of doubt. It wasn't a matter of church history. It was none of those things. It was simply that I didn't feel safe in the community. It was triggering. It was horrible. I didn't know who I could trust because I had been, there were now two bishops in my life that I knew absolutely that I could not trust. I couldn't trust the community that they curated, if you will, because if I couldn't trust the men to make good decisions about sexual predators, then I couldn't trust a single person in their congregation because I didn't know who they were protecting and who they were hiding. So I didn't want to go back. And so I ended up moving to Arizona, kind of starting my life over, and things were going fine. I kind of always thought that I would go back when I was ready. When I had dealt with my own trauma, I would be ready to go back to church and sit my butt in the pews. But right now, I couldn't do that. I could not sit there. It was just too triggering to just, I couldn't do it. So I met my current husband. We started dating. We had a pretty average courtship, not a Mormon courtship. So we moved in together. We had a child all before I was getting married. But then we ended up getting married as well. So I'm happily married now. And I had a child. And then all of a sudden, in about 2016 is when this happened, I was connected with another BYU alumni who was converted to the church by a friend of mine that I grew up with in Arizona. So he served a mission in Provo, Utah, baptized a girl who then went to BYU and then who was raped at BYU. And so I had made a comment on Facebook in regards to abortion and how my feelings about abortion had changed because of my experience being raped at BYU. And he knew his other, you know, this girl that he baptized, he knew her past and her experience at being raped at BYU. And so he connected us. He said, "Oh, I know you and I know you and you're both raped at BYU. You guys should talk," which is wonderful. I'm so glad that he did that. Because I began talking to her. She had a nonprofit that she had created to support victims of sexual assault in the Provo and Utah County area. So she was diligently working on bringing awareness at the ground level at BYU. Not a week had passed since we had connected, and I had started making posts on Facebook right when we got together. "Were you raped at BYU? I was too. Please contact me. You know, we have a group. We want to get together, blah, blah, blah. Let's all support each other." I made that post within a week of me making that post and basically speaking out for the first time in my life that I had been raped. Maddie Barney and all of the court cases and the media press and everything, that began a week later at BYU. So it was quite like destiny, fortuitous, like the coincidence is crazy. That I go public and then within a week, it really hits the media at BYU in a huge way. And so as soon as that happened, I was like, I'm all in. I am all in, because I was horrified and furious that it was still, that what had happened to me, you know, 15, 20 years ago was still happening today and nothing had changed. So that was infuriating, and part of working through my own pain, I wanted to make a difference. You know, I wanted to, you know, this bad thing happened to me and there's nothing I can do about it, but I can turn it around and help other people with my experience. So I spoke out. I started doing lots of media interviews, national media, local media, you name it. I was doing like 6 interviews a week for like a month. So my name was really in the news. I ended up, Elizabeth Smart invited me and my friend who I had met, my very special friend who I had met, they invited the both of us to be interviewed on her nightly show, Crime Watch Daily, about the experience and how we had been treated at BYU, which was, that was phenomenal, because Elizabeth Smart has maintained this faithful yet, critical approach to the way Mormons handle assault because of her experience. So to be interviewed by her, keep in mind, I was still a faithful believing member at this time. So to be interviewed by her was really, really special, because it wasn't, it was hopefully a platform where believing Mormons would listen to me. And that's what I really, really wanted, is I wanted change to happen in the church and at the school. I wanted to change the way people looked at sexual assault and how they treated people who were victims of sexual assault. So I did that interview, and as part of this is kind of where my real faith crisis occurred, because as soon as I became public and my name was all over the media and articles were being written with quotes from me all through it, I made the mistake of reading the comments section, which is never something that anyone ever recommends. And so not only was it strangers that I didn't know, but then my own friends and family on Facebook and in real life who were believing Mormons, they turned on me. They were not supportive because what I was doing was being critical of the church. And so I noticed right away that the people who were wildly supportive of what I was doing and concerned for my well-being were not members of the church. The members of the church in my life could not separate what I was doing, which they perceived as attacking the church, from who I was and from my experience. They couldn't separate the two, so they could not show me any compassion, which was really upsetting. And so that experience really caused me to look at the community again and say, do I really want to be part of this community that as a whole is now rejecting me? I felt that I was excommunicated culturally from my faith community for speaking out. And that sucked. And so, and the most wonderful support that I did find, because my experience was so intertwined with the church and my church experience, the biggest support I found was in ex-Mormon communities. They reached out, they contacted me on Facebook, you know, expressing so much support, so much love, so much understanding. And that's what I needed. And so that's what I gravitated towards. And I joined those communities again with fear and trepidation because they were the enemy. I was a believing member and this was an ex-Mormon community that had now welcomed me in with open arms, full of love. And I'm like, this feels scary, but this is what I need. So I waded in and got what I needed. And then once I was in there, I started, of course, seeing a lot of problematic issues with church and it kind of like, whatever, you know, I was never really concerned with church history because I didn't really care about church history. So the fact that there were issues in church history didn't really matter to me because I didn't really ever feel like that's what my testimony was based on because I didn't know it. So why would problems within it be problematic? Didn't make it. That was my logic. And so it was kind of like this experience that really put another thing on my shelf. Was, you know, being rejected from the community and being welcomed by the ex-Mormon community. And the other interesting thing that happened within this period before the BYU rape thing is I had a baby, a wonderful, the child that I had prayed for 9-10 years at this point. I had a child with my boyfriend who is a never Mormon, and I had to grapple with a lot of temple covenants that I had been taught, that basically told me that because her father was a non-member, I could not be sealed to her for eternity. So my child that I loved, that I had created, I could not be with in the afterlife because of the free agency of her father. Like, okay, back up. So I can't be with my daughter in heaven because of the choice of another person? Like, what? Like, that was like, I'm like, I don't feel like that's not a God I want to believe in. That doesn't feel like God to me. That doesn't feel like heaven to me. I don't understand. Like, that really, like, those eternal temple covenants really, like, didn't jive with my lifestyle anymore. And so I had a lot of reconciliation around that as well. So that, like, having a child and, you know, with a non-member and the BYU, speaking out against BYU, those were basically the things that were like, yeah, this doesn't feel right anymore. And I started listening to Lindsay Hanson Park's A Year of Polygamy. And I knew it took me about 3 months to hit play because I knew that once I hit play, that was the end of my Mormon testimony. I knew that was going to happen because I knew that it was the truth. And so as soon as I started listening, I immediately began to see the patterns in the community that had hurt me, that began from the beginning. And I was like, yeah, this is not a place. This is not healthy. This is not safe. This is not something, this is not a religion based in any God that I believe in. And I don't feel safe in it. And I'm done. And so, I mean, that's basically, that's my faith transition. That was my faith crisis. That's how I got to where I was 2 years ago.
A multi-year, multi-level.
Long story.
Faith crisis. Absolutely. And I appreciate that you're willing to share it with our listeners. And I wanted to just revisit a couple of things, especially in light of a conversation that's going on in the news cycle right now about not reporting sexual assault. There is a Supreme Court nominee who has been accused of sexual assault from when he was a teenager. And it sparked a lot of conversation about what that means about an individual. Is it simply a boys will be boys kind of behavior? We've heard that in some of the conversation. Well, that's just how teenage boys behave. We've heard conversation about, well, that's an indicator that an individual would disregard women. I read one blog post where a woman said that we care more about someone who torments cats as a child because we're concerned that they would abuse children and then others later on in their life. So we care more about cats than we do about women, which I thought was an interesting take on the conversation. But what I'm interested in is the not reporting. You didn't report to the police when this first happened to you. And you talk about you're kind of in the Mormon bubble. And so that didn't occur to you. What are your thoughts on women not reporting now, on your perspective about sexual abuse now?
It's really tough. I've been able to not only reflect on my own experience, but also through my activism, I've come in contact with many, many, many survivors, current survivors, like as in I was friends with you and then you were assaulted and here I am trying to help you through that situation. So I've not only lived my own experience and not reporting, but I've been able to observe and feel kind of the experience of current women and not reporting. So for me, when I was 18, I was a child, and I didn't report because I didn't know that a crime had occurred, for one. And then two, if I actually let myself think about that a crime had occurred and that possibly I could go to the police and report it, as part of the assault, he cleaned me out and removed the evidence. And so I believed that, and it had been, you know, quite some time now, you know, and I'm like, well, there's no evidence. So if I go to the police, they won't believe me anyway, because there's no evidence. And that's kind of the crappy thing about sexual assault, is there's usually no evidence. And so it's literally your word against his every time. And that's a really hard place to be in as a woman, as a victim, as a child. And so I didn't report because no one supported me in reporting. No one told me that that was an option or something I should do. And obviously my bishop didn't, because he treated it as consensual sex. My father, after I had been, you know, not taking the sacrament and reading the miracle of forgiveness and the threat of pregnancy luckily had passed, my mom came to visit me at BYU because she came in town for, you know, what time out for women, or women's week, women's conference, something special at BYU, and education week. That's what it was, education week. And so she visited me, and that's when I kind of just spilled my guts, because I couldn't hold it in anymore. So I told my mom, she immediately called my dad, and my dad asked the right questions. And it wasn't until that conversation with my father that I really understood what had happened to me, because he had a way better grasp and understanding on sexual assaults than anybody, meaning my bishop, really, that I had spoken to. And so he immediately was like, calling, you've been raped. You know, it's not right for your bishop to be punishing you or making you go through the repentance process for, you know, something that was done to you against your will. And so he called my bishop, called off the dogs, basically. And so my punishment ended, and it was my father that told me to go to the health center and get checked out, which I did. And so not only, like, my dad didn't tell me to go to the police, which it's neither here nor there. I'm not going to hold that against him at this point in my life. I went to the medical center, the clinic, BYU Health Clinic. There was no, I think they may have asked me if I went to the police, and I said no, but there was no encouragement. There was no support. There was no, like, you know, this is probably something that you should do. And at this point in my life, I 100% regret that I didn't. I wished I had. I absolutely 100% wish that I had gone to the police. I had nothing to lose. Because I would have had a case. Not only would I have had a case if I had reported it right away. Right away. I think you have like 1 to 3 days that evidence is still fresh that you can go to the police and, you know, have all that done. To collect evidence, but also as an adult, like, well, I have a lot of regret that I didn't, because he was still out there. I knew that I wasn't his only victim, because he told me that I wasn't his only victim. This was just something that he did. And so I knew that other women were potentially being through the same experience that I was, because I didn't report. So that sucked. So I kind of had to live with that. So I 100% wish that I had reported. However, being an advocate in the community now, I've watched a lot of women that, like, if someone comes to me and, you know, tells me, discloses these type of things, because of what happened to me and because I regret not going to the police, I let them know that this is an option and that I will support them if they choose to go to the police. And that, and I just share with them, like, I regret that I didn't go because I don't have a case. I reported 2 years ago and it went nowhere. And he was still out there victimizing people, and I felt terrible for that. And I know that that can't hold, that's not my fault, but I felt like I could have done something differently to prevent that if I had reported. But because I am listening to these women and all they have to lose by reporting, it is horrifying as a woman, or as a victim even. Like, you know, they will lose their job. They'll lose their familial support. There's retaliation that is real. Like all these things or, you know, they may be separated from their spouse at the time. And so there's lots of like custody issues if they were to come forward and report that they had been raped, because why are they being, you know, why are they dating or why are they sexually active? Or, you know, there's all this shame and all this victim blaming that goes along with being a victim of sexual assault. That's all real. And those are the real consequences of reporting sexual assault. And so that's, I haven't read a lot of these why I didn't report hashtag things, because I'm not currently in a place where I can participate. I want to, and I've shared my story multiple times. So I feel like I have, I just haven't done it in hashtag form. But part of being an advocate in a community and an activist in a community where it stems from your own trauma is you kind of have to set boundaries on what you can engage in and what you can't. And I have most recently engaged very, very hard in the Protect LDS Children campaign. And I'm kind of like, I need to, that took a big toll on me about a week or so ago. And so I'm just kind of pulling out of that. So I'm just like, I this is one thing that I can't dip into, but I have a lot to say about it, obviously. So I haven't read a lot of the other why I didn't reports, but I can tell you that I completely, like, there's real reasons why women don't report, because right. Basically it's your word against the rapist, because there is no evidence and you have a lot to lose by reporting. And he had, you know, anyway.
When you talk about this, you're pretty honest about the fact that you were pretty naive when
Absolutely.
All of this happened. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that you were just unsure of about, just basic sex education, basic sexual behavior, yep. et cetera. Even to the point when after your experience and then preparing to marry, not even knowing for sure if you had had sex or not with your intended. So there's a high degree, a high level of either misinformation or lack of information. And so having met your daughter, who is delightful, by the way, it makes me wonder, how has your experience influenced how you are teaching her about her own personal space, safety, her worth and value, her self-image, all those things that would have been helpful for you to have known going in?
Well, since a very early age, basically as soon as she had verbal, any sort of verbal ability, I started trying to give her vocabulary. So I refer to her genitals by their proper name, you know, and it's not a taboo subject. You know, I call it her vagina and her, you know, her butt, basically. So like I try and use the word vagina a lot so that it's something we can talk about, because it's important to talk about, because I want to, you know, then move on to, and I have, now that she's kind of, as she kind of developed cognitively to a point where she has autonomy and can make decisions, and she was interacting with, you know, family members that I may not have trust for, I have had conversations with her about like, who can touch your vagina, and now she's at a point where I'm not even mom, I don't have to touch her vagina, you know, like it's hers and it's only hers, and she, you know, no one can touch it, and if someone does touch it, you need to come tell me. And so that's kind of where I've started with the whole, you know, giving her the vocabulary and the autonomy to have dominion over her own body. She's in control. And that's what I want to give her. And I've also, when it comes to consent, I'm trying really hard to, when you're tickling her and she screams, stop, I'll stop. And she'll be like, why'd you stop, mommy? And I'm like, 'cause you told me to. Oh, you know, and I try and reinforce, if you say stop, I'm going to stop. And it's something that it's really hard as an adult to kind of remember, because adults always tickle kids and they always scream stop and laugh through it and you don't stop. And so it's something that I've tried to do, is kind of respect when she says stop. And it's something that I kind of teach with all of my children. If someone's done being touched, then you need to respect that absolutely. And you never touch someone without their consent. And I mean, and you never touch someone in anger. And so that's kind of something that we all work with at home, and, you know, what touch is okay and what touch isn't okay, and consent and things like that. So that's just something that it's a really difficult thing to teach, but that's kind of what she's four. So that's what I've started doing with her.
It is difficult. And if you don't have the vocabulary and you weren't taught the ways in which to talk about your body and personal space, it is hard to do. And so I think that's why a lot of parents feel uncomfortable having conversations with their children. We have come to the end of the time for our conversation, Colleen. But before we go, I just want to ask you if there's anything else you would like to share with our listeners who are a combination of Community of Christ folks and LDS folks and transitioning Mormons, post-Mormons, ex-Mormons, anything you'd like to share on this topic with our listeners?
In leaving my faith, lately I've been having a lot of discussion about, like, what do I believe now? And when I first went through my faith crisis, it was frightening to lose the faith that I had been raised in, because I was losing kind of my understanding of the way the world worked and why I was on the earth. That was all just kind of gone. And that was really hard to kind of work through and survive. And there was a lot of fear and a lot of panic. At this point now, I've kind of come to a place where I don't know, and I'm okay with not knowing. And that's something that was really hard for me to come out of, because in the Mormon faith, it's drilled into you from a very young age that if you don't know, then you're lost. And if you don't know, like, how can you find any happiness and peace in this life if you don't know what's going to happen when you die, and things like that. And I have had experiences where, like, well, if you turn away from the Lord, then you'll feel this this devastating void and lack, and, you know, his presence won't be in your life. Well, I know that that's not true in my experience. I've still felt a God presence in my life. Yet, I don't really know at this point, or haven't taken the time to pursue, whether I believe in a God. And I'm okay with that, which is huge coming out of Mormonism, because I'm like, yeah, if there is a God, then that's great. I'll figure it out someday. And if there's not, like, I'm okay with that too. Like, I'm at peace. And to me, that peace is so much more important and meaningful than wherever I might go or wherever I've been. Like, I'm on a journey, sure. But the fact that I have peace where I am right now, that's what's most meaningful to me. I think that's it. Just get to a place where you can find peace, and you don't have to have all the answers.
Amen. Thank you for letting us walk with you for a little while on your journey here today on Project Zion podcast. Mm-hmm. It's a timely topic, and one that is important for our listeners to understand. And that's why we have this thread on Project Zion on sex and faith. So we want to thank you, Colleen, for visiting with us on No Filter. And if you would like to hear more from Colleen, you can check out her podcast with the disclaimer that I gave earlier of Read Irreverent, a post-Mormon podcast called Mormon Happy Hour. And we want to thank everyone for listening to No Filter, Conversations on Sex and Faith. We are part of the Project Zion podcast. Join us again for candid conversations. I'm Karen Peter. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.